Today in Studio 360, I try to man up by heading to my local rifle range.
It looks very casual, too, when you don't have your hand on the stock.
Why do you know so much about guns, like the stock? I like take a whole 10-hour course for all those.
I'm from Nebraska. Just I absorbed it.
It sounds manlier that you know all this stuff.
I talk modern masculinity with the writer Joel Stein, and we hear your suggestions for redesigning Canada, starting with a new slogan.
More trees, better radio, fewer idiots.
Canada, 50 shades of flannel.
Canada, the land that crime forgot.
Canada, what's behind that red leaf?
We share Niagara Falls and English.
Nothing personal, Canada, eh? That's ahead in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. After his son was born not long ago, Joel Stein realized he wasn't sure how to do the manly dad thing.
I just saw that smudge on the sonogram, and I pictured having to go camping, teach him how to play baseball, and him getting in fights, and having to watch football on TV. And I realized that, like, I was not equipped to do any of those things.
So Stein came up with this big bucket list of manly man activities, and later I check in with him at, of course, a rifle range. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the European economy, which, I don't need to tell you, is teetering. Greece has been in serious trouble for years, and now Spain and Italy. This may be one of those great historical inflection points that ends very badly. But there's one place in Europe this week where the good times are rolling. Art Basel, the continent's oldest and biggest contemporary art fair in the Swiss city where Switzerland, France, and Germany meet. Art Basel has grown offshoots in Miami and Hong Kong, but the original Swiss edition is still a must-go place for tens of thousands of collectors and dealers from all over the world. And art journalists as well, of course. Sarah Thornton is author of 7 Days in the Art World, and she's covering Art Basel for The Economist magazine. Sarah, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So you're just getting back from a full day at the fair. How are collectors and dealers and all those art people dealing with the European economic crises?
They seem to be ignoring it.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Remarkably, Art Basel is a kind of parallel universe where the market is not teetering, but chugging along as usual. And that is partly because high net worth individuals, as they're called, are fleeing the euro. And one of the attractions of art for them is that you can buy your Andy Warhol or your Jeff Koons and you in any currency, and then you can sell it off in whatever currency is powerful at the moment, whether it's Brazilian real or Hong Kong dollars.
So because the art market is, as we've been told, the largest unregulated global market in the world, it sort of transcends the currency crises of the moment.
And as do these super rich people. They seem to live in their own economy, one quite different from ours.
As you walked around today, what were the most interesting or telling moments or things you observed?
Well, you know, there seems to be a lot of buying going on and a fair amount of excitement. And one of the things that's interesting to notice is the emotions of collectors as they go through the day. They tend to get really high when they make a purchase and can become quite angry and dejected if someone else beat them to a work that they're keen to buy. And so, you know, there seems to be a fair amount of activity going on, quite a bit of art trading hands.
I read that there's a London dealer offering for sale a Mark Rothko painting called Untitled 1954, asking $78 million. Is that one of these classic modern masterpieces that is causing a lot of buzz and interest?
Well, you know, there are very few people who are in the market for a $78 million Rothko, and possibly only three people, one of whom bought a Rothko for $86 million in New York at Christie's a few weeks ago. So it may be the person that won the Rothko at Christie's in May would also like to acquire this one, or it may be that their desire for Rothko has been satiated. You know, there are very few people who can afford $78 million works, and then an even smaller group of them want an orange abstract Rothko.
Yeah. The meltdown that we are still experiencing began and continues with the popping of property bubbles around the world, including the United States and all over Europe. Is there any sense that this, too, is a bubble? Because the art market never had its big 2008-2009 correction, right? It's just sort of stayed in these dizzy expensive heights.
Well, you know, there was a correction of sorts in the autumn of 2008 all the way through to the autumn of 2009. There was about a 12 or 15 month recession, I guess, but it's come back in full force. I mean, the metaphor I tend to use is that of the bubble bath. So we have lots of little bubbles, and they're always kind of bursting, and then new bubbles are forming. And because the art market is not a unified thing, it's incredibly fragmented, and really it's a combination of hundreds of artists' markets.
The collectors and the dealers, I guess, aren't feeling the heat and terror of the Euro meltdown and the political upheaval. But presumably artists being artists are attuned to this. Are there any signs of that? Any protest art or political art happening on the fringes of Basel?
Very, very little. I remember seeing a Thomas Hirschhorn work, who's a Swiss artist based in Paris, who does a lot of very politicized pieces on the stand. I think of Stephen Friedman, a London-based dealer, but that's... They really are few and far between. The super rich don't tend to be left-leaning, and they'd rather not put it up in their dining room.
Well, Sarah, enjoy your $65 10-minute cab rides in Basel.
Yes, I'm trying to avoid cab rides. I'm walking as much as possible.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Sarah Thornton is author of 7 Days in the Art World, and she's covering Art Basel for The Economist. Last week, we kicked off our latest redesign project, Canada, the whole darn country. My Canadian fellow radio host, John Gomeshi, put it best, probably, when he said,
"It's not what you think of us, Kurt. It's that you don't think of us."
And already, we've solved that. Thinking of you constantly, Canada. To help us make the Canada brand more vivid and memorable, we have hired the international design firm Bruce Mau Design. They've created marketing campaigns for the likes of Coca-Cola, GE, MTV. Hunter Tura is the president and CEO of Bruce Mau Design, and he joins me now. Thanks for helping us out with this, Hunter.
Well, we're very excited to take part in the project. As you may know, we are an organization that has offices in both the U.S. and Canada, and so this is a topic that is something that we actively think about and, frankly, live with every day.
The name on the door, Bruce Mau, he's Canadian. Are you Canadian as well?
No, I'm American. And
thank God.
I'm a nutmegger, so from New England.
Well, then, you're, as an American who has lived in Canada for a while, you're even more perfect than I realized as the person to be in charge of our team. We talked to some Canadians here in New York about what their issues are, and let's listen to that.
What's the one thing Americans should know about Canada?
I only get to say one.
We're much better recyclers than Americans are.
We're not as nice as we seem.
You know, it would be nice if they actually knew who our prime minister was at any given point in time.
I wish Americans realized that 20% of the foreign oil comes from Canada.
There's the same percentage of Canadians that say A as Americans who say y'all.
Say the exchange rate, because everyone still has like a picture of it back 10 years ago.
That our healthcare system actually works.
You can see those and other Canadians in a video at studio360.org. Actually, of all those, I was most interested in the guy who said the fraction of Canadians who say eh is the same as the fraction of Americans who say y'all.
Yeah, the one that I was immediately drawn to was the exchange rate.
Yeah. I had an idea today. Every time certain political events or candidates happen in the United States where somebody looks like they're going to win, all kinds of people, especially American liberals, say, oh, if he gets elected, I'm moving to Canada. Maybe there's a little sub-campaign to encourage American defectors.
I think if more Americans knew, you know, how great a place it is to live and work and so forth, you know, I think that campaign would begin to get some traction.
Well, and since I don't think the government of Canada would ever go there, maybe in our version of this rebranding, we can, because we don't care if the State Department is mad at us.
That's right. That's right.
So once you've gathered your team from within your firm to tackle this, what is the next step?
So first a note on our team. It's an all-American team.
Really? Okay. Good.
Really to see this in a clear-eyed way. Come up with some key insights that then will drive a set of design proposals. We'll look at those design proposals around, you know, these kind of key themes that we hope to express. Who are we? What is the brand of Canada? There's an incredible amount of navel gazing around that question. I mean, I have two theories on that. One is around the relative newness of the country. I mean, it was only founded in 1867.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's one thing. And then again, it's an incredibly fluid society, particularly around immigration and globalization. Hopefully, you know, we're able to break through some of that. And, you know, we'll show you some of that work in a couple of weeks.
Well, great. We will check back in a couple of weeks and see where we are. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks for having us.
Hunter Tura is president and CEO of Bruce Mau Design. Next week, we'll check in with them to see how the work's going. Meanwhile, we want you to help us help Canada. Last week, we kicked off our slogan contest, and we've already gotten more than 300 entries.
Canada, 50 shades of flannel.
Canada, the land that crime forgot.
Canada, what's behind that red leaf?
We share Niagara Falls and English.
More trees? Better radio, fewer idiots.
Glacially scrubbed every few thousand years.
Those are some of them, and at the end of this month, we'll pick our favorite, and the copywriter of the best one will win a trip to Washington, D.C. If you've sent us a slogan in the last week or two, you've already entered our contest, and if not, you can enter your slogan and learn more at redesigningcanada.com.
How come you never go there? How come I'm so alone?
Coming up, it's Father's Day when we think about what it takes to be a dad. But what's it take to be a man?
So, gentlemen, these are 50 shots. It holds 10 magazines.
Now this is where it gets cool.
These bullets are much smaller than bullets I've seen before. I mean, I feel like I could get shot by this and not die. Is that wrong?
That's wrong.
Okay.
The writer Joel Stein and I lock and load, literally, at the rifle range. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Hi, Joel. It's Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
How are you?
A couple of years back, when the writer Joel Stein found out he and his wife were expecting a son, he had a bit of a freak out. I called him up to talk about it.
I just saw that smudge on the sonogram, and I pictured having to go camping.
Right.
And, you know, having to teach him how to play baseball, and him getting in fights, and having to watch football on TV. And I realized that, like, I was not equipped to do any of those things.
Because you grew up the same sort of weenie that I did, not doing any of those things.
I grew up in the heart of, like, Blue State, New Jersey, feminist mom, free to be you and me, Alan all the time.
So Joel set out very deliberately to fix that. He went hunting and fishing, shadowed firefighters, survived 3 days of army boot camp. He even got punched by an ultimate fighting champion. And he's written about all that in a new memoir called Man Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. So your book has now officially been published and you're going on a book tour. You're coming here next week, right?
Yeah, I'm coming to New York to do some TV and speak in some places where I hope people show up.
Well, I've got an idea. When you're in town, how about you and I head over to the rifle range?
Where in New York City? I mean, yes, I would like. Well, I'm just curious where you can do that in New York City.
Best of all, it's in Chelsea. Yeah, there's a gun range there on 20th Street, and we can meet up there and be manly together.
I can't believe this exists in New York, and I'm excited to exploit it.
So Joel Stein and I met up at the West Side Pistol and Rifle Range. It's in a big, grungy basement of an office building. Fluorescent lights, linoleum floors, metal lockers lining the wall. But before we could shoot, we had to get a lesson from our instructor, Raymond.
Okay, so I'll give you the firearm right now, gentlemen. So just point the muzzles up, hold it this way, refrain from clenching the trigger.
Okay.
Who are you more concerned about safety-wise between the two of us?
It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
Let us know when you have a good sense. Now, when I shot when I was a kid, it wasn't semi-automatic. There was no magazine.
The bolt action 22. Yeah. Primarily, 22s are used in Olympics, biathlons.
Right.
They drop their face down like this, really resting it on the stock.
It looks very casual, too, when you don't have your hand on the stock.
Why do you know so much about guns, like the stock? I, like, take a whole 10-hour course for all this.
I'm from Nebraska. Just I absorbed it.
It sounds manlier that you know all this stuff, the stock.
It's my generation versus yours.
Do you really think so?
Partly. Yeah, I think you just kind of learned it more.
Now, let's insert the magazine. Just point it up first on the ceiling in that position. Now, the pin faces down this way. Insert it this way, all the way flush. Exactly. See?
Sounded good.
Okay. Oh, that's cool.
Way to go.
Okay. So try your index finger here.
Sorry.
For the record, Joel Stein's magazine dropped to the floor. It reminds you why you shouldn't probably be drinking while you're shooting guns.
Exactly. There's a lot of things to do, right?
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, there's a lot of little mistakes to be made.
Guys, lock your bolts back so we're safe. And
there we go.
Nice. All safety's right. On. So you want to keep that weapon in that position when you're finished.
My arm's already tired holding this
Me
gun.
Too. I wasn't going to say anything.
Okay. I think we'll be loading up the ammunition outside, so go now. So, gentlemen, these are 50 shots. It holds 10 magazines.
And this is where it gets cool.
Well, these bullets are much smaller than bullets I've seen before. I mean, I'm not mocking the bullets at all. I feel like I could get shot by this and not die. Is that wrong?
That's wrong.
Okay. Have you ever been shot by one of these?
No.
I was once shot by a BB gun by my brother. He said, run out there. I'll shoot you. It'll be cool.
What?
And yes, he did when I was like 7. And he hit me, and I fell. And he still talks about it as the coolest thing ever because I felt like he'd shot me and killed me.
Wait, so you agreed to this? You said it would be cool.
He was my big brother. He was 12. I was 7.
And do you have any memory of how much it hurt?
It hurt a lot, and a huge bruise. And,
yeah. Did you go to the hospital?
No.
Okay.
Loading the ammunition into the 10 magazines took a few minutes. That gave me a chance to ask Joel if participating in all these manly stunts for the book had actually turned him into a different kind of father.
Definitely.
Really?
Yeah. I would have avoided taking him camping, for instance, before he did this. And clearly he wants to go camping already at 3. He's just interested in sleeping outside. So we'll go sleep in the backyard soon and then go on a real camping trip. I don't think my parents could have forced me to do things I really hated.
Right.
But I at least want to expose him to more.
It's as though, I mean, there's a certain unintentional time travel aspect to this whole thing. I mean, because I'm older, I went through the normal 60s Boy Scout camping thing that you didn't do.
Was your dad much manlier than you?
Oh, yeah, I mean, he fought in World War II. He was a big jock. He grew up in a small he was.
And what do you imagine his dad was like?
Well, I knew him. I mean, you know, he was, you know, fought in World War I. Big guy, you know, big Danish guy, you know.
But was he even, like, less emotive and...
Yeah.
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 So you can imagine.
No, there was a progress in terms of in terms of expressiveness and all that between his father and him and then me.
And that's just what we can see. Like, imagine if we went back several hundred or a thousand years.
Right.
I imagine men were
back to the Vikings?
Yeah.
Right.
Do you want me to finish your magazine for you?
Almost done. I'm almost done. I'm just doing it better. I'm doing it more carefully.
Hang on, gentlemen. So here are your eye protection.
You don't wear glasses?
I got LASIX.
Oh.
Also very manly.
Yeah, really?
Okay, guys, so let me hear your targets.
Oh, that guy's no good. I definitely want to shoot that guy.
That guy is the iconic mid-century thug. He's just a black and white drawing, but really mean looking. This thick head of black hair, jowly face, bushy eyebrows, hairy forearms, and aiming a pistol right at me.
If you got robbed in the 1950s, this is the man who would be robbing you.
Exactly.
We're shooting at Jimmy Cagney.
That's great.
I don't even know where to shoot him at. Where are we aiming?
Head.
Not the heart?
Don't shoot at the groin, Joel. Don't shoot at the groin.
But he's wearing, like, tweeded pants. He deserves it.
By the way, listeners, you're about to hear some gunshots.
Hey, gentlemen, so lock and load.
I should fire?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's loud. Wait. How many times should I shoot?
Seven remaining. Just go slow first. You want to train. You want to start slow. Relax and breathe.
Okay. I'm not entirely sure I ever hit the target.
Ah, the smell. I love the smell. It's a smell I haven't smelled in many, many years. After firing our first five rounds, we looked at our targets.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, yeah, you killed me.
These are much better than I imagined we would do.
Well, we were at 25 feet. They were
still.
We could have punched the target from where we were.
It's fun, right?
Yeah, really fun.
It is fun.
All right, we'll do 50 feet.
The whole target mechanism is really just heavy twine and an old-fashioned pulley crank.
Smells like victory, doesn't it?
Amazingly, I managed to hit again and again right where I was told to aim, the thug's chest.
Oh, come on. I hit him in the gelled hair instead of the heart, which is where I was supposed to be aiming. Did you practice before we came?
No!
Can anyone find out? Did Kurt come here?
Good job.
Thanks. Joel, you're being very quiet.
I'm proud of you.
No, it's Miller time, right?
We gotta clean up our casings.
We do. Joel Stein's new book is called Man Made, A Stupid Quest for Masculinity. And you can see a video of our gun adventure in Manhattan at studio360.org. And by the way, I really, really did kick his ass. So Joel Stein was trying to be a better father by doing all these manly things like shooting, but those kinds of activities aren't the only way for fathers and sons, or fathers and daughters for that matter, to bond. In honor of Father's Day, we have this story from Ed Zimmerman, a lawyer in New York, about the music that brought him closer to his father, Sam.
My father was obsessed with opera. Above and beyond everything, opera and classical music to a slightly lesser extent, and books. He was a voracious, tireless reader, and I could also see that opera had this healing effect on him. And my father drove a cab and delivered pizza and sold galoshes out of the back of his station wagon, but mostly what I remember when I call him to mind, which is actually frequent, is my father working in the boiler room of our basement, listening to George Jelinek on a little transistor radio, addressing and stamping envelopes for a home improvements company in Brooklyn.
Hello, this is George Jelinek. In the spring of 1912, The three most celebrated and most expensive male operatic stars, Enrico Caruso, Tita Ruffo, and Fyodor Shalyapin, were part of the same ensemble. They made a brief...
He was just sticking labels on, writing labels for direct mailing, and I guess they thought that having them handwritten would make them have a higher open rate. And it's interesting that I've actually worked with companies that spend a lot of time thinking about open rates on direct mail over email. And the opera, I think, made that stuff bearable.
The lyric voice we hear is already colored with the dramatic qualities that would dominate it in later years. Here is the voice of Enrico Caruso in his 29th year.
Caruso was someone he worshipped, and he had this autographed picture of Caruso. It's one of two family heirlooms, only two, that he gave to me, that he had, and he didn't have stuff of great financial value. With Caruso, my father felt that there were people who had a bigger voice, there were people who had a purer voice, there were people who had a bigger range, there were people who had more presence, but no one had a combination of two or three or four of those things that could come close to Caruso. There were some things that he gave me in terms of a tool set to dissect literature or dissect music. That same tool set happens to be extraordinarily helpful as a lawyer when you're looking at the written word or listening to the spoken word. When I went to become a summer associate at Lowenstein Sandler, my current law firm, I wanted to do litigation and I got stuck on a corporate project early on. My first corporate project was to look at a paragraph and to think about what they were trying to do that they weren't saying and what the hidden implications were. And I felt like I was home as soon as I got that project. And it was a real turning point. But I realized that I had never been exposed to business. I had never read the Wall Street Journal. I had never looked at the business section of the New York Times. I had never had any reason to, but the practice of the craft of unbundling the written word or the spoken word. That comes from my father, and it's a gift. I didn't realize it was going to be a gift in later life, and he had no idea he was training me, but it's a gift I'm trying to give to my children, and maybe they'll thank me for it later, and maybe they won't. When he was dying of cancer in the hospital, we talked for hours about music. Maybe we needed a vocabulary as a young adult son talking to his father, who wasn't a very emotion-filled guy, except in music. And I think I needed the escape as well, because I won't forget having to authorize my father's DNR, do not resuscitate, order. I won't forget my father asking me how long he had to live. And so moving from that to talking about why Maria Callas was overrated, I talk about Callas all day long.
Ed Zimmerman of New York City talking about his father, Sam Zimmerman. Our story was produced by Studio 360's Julie Burstyn. Is there some cultural moment you shared with your father? A book, a comic strip, a game, a movie, or even with your mom? We want to hear those stories, so write to us at studio360.org. Coming up, the novelist Jessamine Ward tells me how living through an epic storm led to her prize-winning novel. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. When you see artificial limbs in popular culture, they're usually meant to be pathetic or menacing or both. Think Captain Hook in Peter Pan or the goofy station inspector in the movie Hugo. But can prostheses actually be awesome? A design company in San Francisco says yes, they can, and they're using a revolutionary new technology to do it. Cynthia Graber has the story.
Picture this. You just got into an accident and you lost part of your leg. I know, pretty macabre. Just think about it for a minute. Your leg is gone, and so you get a mechanical one.
When I look at a prosthetic limb, a standard one, it really looks like a machine that was designed by an engineer for an engineer.
Because really, prosthetics are boring. Instead of the curves of your muscles, you now have a straight metal pole. It's got a standard plastic foot at the end. People look at you a little funny. You're not in the mood to wander around in shorts.
It's very brilliantly designed. There's nothing wrong with the design. It simply looks to me like a job that's only half complete. It's as though you took a car and stripped it down to the chassis and said, there, we're done.
Scott Summit is an industrial designer. He worked for Apple in the 90s and made all sorts of high-tech bits for Silicon Valley companies. A few years ago, he formed a company called Bespoke Innovations to create covers for the artificial legs. He calls the new products fairings.
The fairings on a motorcycle are the parts which wrap the engine and give it the kind of sex appeal and the sense of contour and flow that you see on a motorcycle.
You guys agree that I had a pretty good run down here? I didn't fall or anything.
That's Chad Crittenden on Survivor in 2004. He'd lost his foot and part of his calf to a rare form of cancer a couple years earlier.
Great. The guy with the mechanical legs can win for sure. He's nice, he's smart, he's quiet, and he's got the underdog thing going on. So we're screwed.
That's awesome.
You know, at the time, I didn't feel a whole sense of loss or anything that was lacking. But it's almost like I didn't know what I was missing.
But he just had a pole where his super muscular calf used to be. He managed. He was able to go snowboarding, mountain biking, even still play soccer. But then his prosthetist, that's the person who measures and fits someone with a new limb, he put Crittenden in touch with Scott Summit.
We went over all kinds of different interests and sort of things that are aesthetically pleasing to me.
They batted ideas back and forth. Crittenden told Summit he loves circles.
He kind of got an idea, worked something up on the computer, and we went with it. And it was just awesome. I still love my very first one.
Summit designed him a cover that mirrored the form of his shapely old leg, but looks nothing like it. It has a shiny chrome finish on the back, and the matte black front has these big irregular circular cutouts. They look kind of like rocks on a riverbed. Crittenden was so into his new leg that he got a job at Bespoke Innovations. He was working a convention when he met Brooke Artisi.
I went right up to their booth and I was like, I need one. I was like, I have to have it.
Why? What was it? What made you think I have to have it?
Just because I had, I'm about like this artsy look, this, very prominent. They're striking.
She lost part of her leg in a train accident when she was 15.
Young, I'm blonde. I'm not the typical amputee population that you see walking down the street.
Her fairing is chrome. It's got a swirling pattern of black layered over so the silver shines through. It's pretty badass.
It looks like a Terminator.
Here we have a part that is tooled leather. It has kind of a cowboy boot feel to it.
At the Bespoke office in San Francisco, you can order a leg with a herringbone pattern, or one cut out with what look like flower petals. Another's covered with repeating geometric shapes like Moorish tiles.
Here's one for that we did for a Special Forces commando. It has a look of adrenaline on it. this kind of exploding energy coming from it.
If you decide to go for it, a bespoke leg will cost you about $4,000 to $6,000. They're not covered by most insurance plans, but that's a tiny fraction of what something like this would have cost with traditional mold making. It took a couple of new technologies to make it possible.
Everything is silent, so it makes for a very boring radio demonstration, I'm afraid.
Summit sticks Crittenden in front of a projector. It's hooked up to some cameras and a computer. He's demonstrating a three-dimensional scanner.
And a blast of lights in grid shapes shoots out across the room. Chad is now being scanned. A bunch of lines are superimposed on his body. And a few seconds later, there we go. We've got a three-dimensional representation of Chad on the computer screen.
They copy the remaining limbs so that the new prosthesis cover can match the shape. Once the design is finished, it's time for the final step, three-dimensional printing. Bespoke sends the designs to an industrial printer off-site. You know, we're staring here through this glass cover, and we can see this, like, black box moving over all these pieces. What is it doing?
So the little black box that's moving around is the head of the machine. So it has...
This is one kind of 3D printer. The machines lay down strings of plastic or different types of powder and then harden the material into pretty much any object you can think of.
So you can see kind of this is all printed in layers. So you can see very fine layers. They're 10,000ths of an inch thick.
There's a lot of research these days into prosthetics. In part, that's because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Department of Veterans Affairs says that more than 1,200 vets have come home amputees.
We were on a foot patrol during my deployment in Afghanistan and stepped on a landmine.
Matt Sullivan was at the VA hospital in San Diego last year when he saw one of the fairings.
It caught my eye instantly because it was the polished chrome look to it, and I'd never seen it before.
Summit scanned him right there that same day. Then Sullivan went home. He spent a few weeks thinking about a design.
And then ultimately I decided, you know, I was like, you know what? I'm such a huge San Diego sports fan.
He has the Chargers lightning bolt on the back of his leg cut into chrome. The front black section has an embossed SD for the Padres. It's like the ultimate tattoo.
You know, when you have a tattoo done, you know, typically you like showing people, talking about it. Same thing with the fairing.
And I get, what happened to you, normally? Very rude question. And then, but now I get, what is that? You know, and it's like, and then like, that's really cool. You know, never seen anything like it, and, you know, good for you, and, you know. So you're not going to walk down the street in a bespoke cover and someone go, oh, that looks just like your real leg. No, it looks like a piece of artwork walking down the street.
Even with all sorts of recent advances in prosthetic technology, nobody can give you a limb as good as the one you were born with. Bespoke wants to give you one thing your old leg never had. Bragging rights. For Studio 360, I'm Cynthia Graber.
You can see some images of those customized artificial limbs at studio360.org. So it's summer. The season when people everywhere, A, get a taste of what it's like to live in a subtropical climate, and B, feel like they have time to read more, especially fiction. So this is a perfect time to read Jessamyn Ward's novel Salvage the Bones, which just came out in paperback. I spoke with her last year before her novel won the National Book Award. Salvage the Bones tells a story set in the Mississippi Gulf Coast during the days leading up to and during Hurricane Katrina. Ward grew up in a town like the one she writes about, a place she calls Bois Sauvage. I asked her when she decided to write a novel about Katrina.
It took me a few years to commit to writing about the hurricane. I think that the hurricane was so awful and so devastating that it actually silenced me for a while. So it wasn't until around like 2007 that I decided that I wanted to tackle the hurricane in fiction. And even then, when I began writing the novel, I didn't actually call the hurricane in the novel Hurricane Katrina until, say, like halfway through the novel. And then I thought, this is stupid. I know which storm I'm writing about. Yeah. I should call it Hurricane Katrina.
And you at that moment were no longer living on the Gulf Coast. Describe how you came to be there during the hurricane.
So I was attending the University of Michigan, and I had just finished up my MFA program in fiction, but I was scheduled to return to Ann Arbor in late August to begin teaching. But because I'm always so homesick, I thought, well, you know, I'll just stay here, you know, until the last moment. Like, I'll stay here through the hurricane, and then I'll, you know, drive up to Michigan, because I totally underestimated the storm. And then we didn't know that it was a Category 5 until the night before it hit, you know, and it hit early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't know what I was doing. I totally underestimated it.
And what was it like for you and your family as you experienced it?
It was terrifying. My mom lives in a trailer, which you can never stay in trailers during a hurricane. So we spent the night at my grandmother's house. And then when we woke up at like 6, 7 a.m., the storm was there. And then all of a sudden, water was inside the house, and her house had never flooded before. And we'd been over there, you know, for like countless, you know, sort of hurricanes, lesser storms. Mm-hmm. And then the water rose very, very quickly. And the water rose so quickly that we were afraid that we would drown inside the house. And we didn't want to climb into the attic because we didn't want to climb into the attic and drown. So we had to leave the house during the middle of the storm. And a lot of our cars were washed away. So we got into our trucks that had escaped the flood. And we actually were trying to make it to the local church, but we weren't able to make it there. And so we actually sat in a field, a high field, for a large portion of the storm until the water receded enough so that we could drive a little further. But still then we couldn't get to the church. And some of us were rescued by some neighbors that had a boat. Some of us were able to make it in our trucks a little later, and we were taken in by a family for the duration, for the rest of the storm.
So it sounds just about as scary as the storm as that you fictionalized in Salvage the Bones.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
The heroine and narrator is a 15-year-old girl named Esh, who lives in this house of men. Her mother had died in childbirth a few years earlier, and is a serious reader. She mentions having just read As I Lay Dying. She refers a lot, recurringly, to Greek gods and goddesses, which is not, being this incredibly literate girl at 15 is not the character you would expect this poor girl in a small town in the Gulf Coast to be. Was that part of who she would be for you from the beginning?
When I sort of discovered, I knew that she would be reading over the summer. Like, I knew that she read, because I figured that she read in order to not be so isolated, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew that she would do well in English classes, and she would take her assignments seriously, and she would do them during the summer. But then, as I wrote the novel, she surprised me with how much she identified with those characters from the myths, and how she attached to the character of Medea, and saw something of that character in herself, and how that troubled her. She saw something of herself in those myths. And was able to sort of refer to them to try to understand her existence, and try to make sense of what she was dealing with during that time.
Is Esh at 15 a little bit like you at 15, a lot like you at 15? How does she compare?
Because she was a reader, and because she was using books to escape. In that way, I think that she reflects me at 15. But then, and all the other, you know, in how promiscuous she is, and how she sort of sees the world and navigates the world, I think that she's very much her own character. But I do think that her love of books is, there's a little bit of me in there at 15.
You must have always been the smart kid in town, right?
I was always the smart kid. you know, it's funny because, you know, when I graduated from high school, I was a smart kid who was applying to all these Ivy League
fancy
big
colleges,
schools. Yeah, fancy colleges to go to school. But like, I think back to even when I was in elementary school and, you know, and I would get teased and kids would call me a bookworm. So that stigma of being the smart kid has been with me from the beginning.
You call this town Bois Sauvage, which means wild wood, which has a kind of mythological ring, as if these children, these teenagers, are living a kind of Lord of the Flies existence. Was that intentional, that there's a sort of fabulistic quality?
Originally, actually the name Bois Sauvage, I took it from my first book. I'm writing about a fictionalized version of the place that I grew up, which is named DeLille, right? Mm-hmm. But DeLille is the second name for the town. The first name for the town, before it was named for a French settler, it was called Wolftown. And so that's actually why I came up with the French name Bois Sauvage, because one of the, I think that one of the meanings for sauvage can actually be wolf.
Huh.
And so I wanted that name to sort of reflect the history of the town that I come from.
So you read a lot as a kid, but at what point did you decide, I really want to be a writer?
Honestly, it was after my brother died. I actually sort of graduated from high school in Mississippi, and then I attended college at Stanford University, which Stanford University is a great university, but because of my background, you know, I come from a poor black rural community. I was totally overwhelmed at Stanford, and I thought that I did not belong there. And that doubt regarding, you know, like my, you know, intelligence followed me throughout my time there. And so I didn't commit to being a writer while I was there, because I thought, I took like one fiction class, and I just thought that I wasn't good enough. And I never spoke in class, and, you know, I struggled the entire time. But it wasn't until I graduated from Stanford, and I still harbored that sort of secret dream of being a writer. And I graduated from Stanford, and then the year after I graduated from Stanford, during that year, that's when my younger brother died. He was 19. He was hit by a drunk driver. And that changed everything for me, because, you know, he taught me an important lesson, that it's so cliche, but you know, we're not promised anything, and that we can die at any time, and that and so, you know, I realized that, and I was sort of living with that loss every day, and with that realization every day, because I loved him and I missed him so much. And I thought, well, what could I do with my life that, you know, that if I did die in like a month or a year or tomorrow or whenever, that I would feel like I'd lived a life worth living, and I'd done something that makes me happy and that serves some purpose. And then I thought, writing, like, that's what I want to do. I want to be a writer. And so, you know, like I sort of went against my better judgment, you know, which told me that I should attempt to, you know, study for the LSAT and go to law school or find a more practical profession. And I decided to commit to writing, and that's when I began applying to MFA programs.
Do you, living in Northern California and Ann Arbor, Michigan, do you miss the South? And if so, what do you miss about it?
I do miss the South. You know, while I was in those places, this is going to sound strange, but I missed the air. You know, it's very humid.
You talk about it. There's a lot of humidity in this book.
Yes, yes, and it's hot. And I found that when I was in the South, and I think it's partly because it's where I'm from, and I have a very large extended family in DeLille, and I have a community where, you know, everyone knows everyone, and everyone's been living there forever. And so I think that, you know, that I missed that, but that I sort of associated that close-knit, tight feeling with the feeling of humidity and heat, because when you're in that kind of humidity, it feels like the air is embracing you. It's so heavy and so thick. I mean, there's a lot that even as I love Mississippi, there's a lot that I dislike about Mississippi. There's much that I hate about Mississippi, but, you know, that's home. So,
yeah. But you, on the other hand, you presumably wouldn't have become who you've become, a well-regarded novelist and the rest, had you not left, right?
Exactly. Because it taught me, you know, being away from home, I think, helped me to commit to writing about it when I did. Partly maybe because I was sort of writing into that homesickness because I missed it so much and thinking so much about home and like my place there and if I could have a place there. It helped me see things more clearly, and it helped me sort of, I guess, like more easily embrace the love that I felt for that place and for those people.
Jessamyn Ward, thank you very much for coming into Studio 360 today.
Thank you for having me.
Jessamyn Ward's Salvage the Bones won the 2011 National Book Award for Fiction. It is now out in paperback, and you can hear her reading an excerpt for us at studio360.org. And that's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. And do not forget our Rebranding Canada project. Enter the contest for a new slogan for Canada, and the winner gets a trip to Washington, D.C. All the information you need is at redesigningcanada.com. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Julia Barton,
Krista Ripple,
Majahid Solomon,
Eve Asher,
Sarah Gook,
Julia Wetherill.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, it looks human, but changes at night to satisfy its horrible appetites.
I just kept the parts of the myth that I thought were cool. Silver bullets, I mean, silver's fantastic. Why would you want to ditch that?
Werewolves and the writer who loves them. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.